Fact of Vengeance, Patriot Fact, Facts Naturally. Oh, that's kind of good.
Hello, St. Andrews and science fans from around the world. It's Valentine's Day this week, and we will be exploring the science of love. This is our science podcast, Fact Naturally. I am David Pritchard, and with me, as always, is Dan Ray.
Yo.
And Zach Hall.
What's up, baby girl?
Anyway, love is in the air. It's Valentine's Day this week. And as such, we've been thinking about the science of love. Before we get to that, we'll just have a little bit thinking about love in humans and other animals, in which the other animals are loving each other rather than... Well, you know where that's going.
Yeah, my topic for this week wasn't approved.
Yes, I know. We wouldn't let Zach talk about that. Well, we loosely termed animal husbandry.
Wives too. I don't understand the name.
Just as this week, couples will be getting together, giving each other's gifts, getting to know one another and celebrating their love, which I'm sure Dan and Zach will later tell us is nothing more than a chemical reaction. So too, in the animal kingdom, not this time this week, actually sometimes throughout the spring and sometimes all year round, couples are getting together, exchanging gifts, forming pair bonds, getting ready to bring up chicks and do other stuff together.
That's how I lose every girl, is when I start calling it a pair bond. This is for life!
This is another reason why I'm single. But anyway, this is seen throughout the animal kingdom. They're not necessarily all pair bonds, there are different types of mating systems, and research has shown that actually interestingly relates to ecology, but we're not going to get bogged down in that. Let's just think about the most analogous one to humans, because since it's Valentine's Day, long-term pair bonds. In particular, there's some nice work that's come out of Cambridge recently about how Eurasian jays, which are a type of corvid, like crows and other things, which are obviously a type of bird, how they maintain their pair bond. So during their courtship behavior and just throughout the pair bond itself, they have these kind of bonding activities. For example, they will preen one another. And in the topic of this research, they provision each other with food. They give gifts of food. Just as people next week will be giving each other gifts, so too do the jays. Although the jays give gifts of mealworms and wax moths and what they can get their hand on.
Whereas I bet the female never pays.
And we only give gifts of wax moths.
Yeah, exactly. We're not going to go anywhere near those mealworms. That's disgusting. Anyway, so these birds give gifts to each other. But as is traditional on all Valentine's Day, what do you get the female jay that has everything? The answer? What she isn't already sick of.
Diamonds from De Beers. If yep. Commercials have taught me anything. Oh, and you can get her... I think you can get her SUV, but it's only if it's got one of those big ribbons on top of it.
If it's her own Christmas, you can pack the entire thing in wrapping paper.
I always fear that...
You saw the J version of Super Sweet 16, right?
Yeah, yes.
Or, and they had the SUV J. made entirely from mealworms.
Get that J, what she's never had before. A live performance by CeeLo Green.
We're looking at you, J.J. Abrams.
And a shout out from Jay-Z.
Who is the most famous of all the Jays. Anyway.
Oh man, I made a joke in that. I didn't even realize.
I was wondering if you picked that up.
Anyway, so these researchers were seeing whether the males were able to give what could be seen as an appropriate gift to the female. So rather than making a massive social faux pas and giving the females what actually it is that the male Jays would like as a present, they're seeing how well they could track what their female partner desired. So they split the Jays into two different rooms. And the females were given one of two different foods. So they were wax moths and mealworms. And they were given this one type of food until they were absolutely sick of it. Now, the male, Jay, is watching this from another room. Can see the female getting sick of this food. They then opened a partition and let the two Jays in together. And when it came round to giving gifts of food, both foods were available. But the male Jays only gave the females... the appropriate food, so the food that the female hasn't had being fed to.
So they were actually paying attention to what the female was eating.
They were, and they had controls in the experiment, so The males were not able to do this as they couldn't see the female. So it's not they're just responding to the smell of the food on the female or the female behaving as though, like, oh, I got a belly full of mealworms or something like that. They also, the female had to be sated. So they had to have what is called put into a kind of a state. So when we talk about state, it means that I am full of this type of food is a state. I am hungry is a state. I am hungry for this type of food is a state. So they were put into a specific state, which is I have full of this type of food, but I haven't had any of this type of food.
That's why I wish I could cook more than spaghetti.
Yeah. We all do, Dan.
We're all so bloated.
It's only when the females were made so they were sick of one food and kind of would desire another that the males provided it to them. So it seems that in this provisioning that people who have studied bird behaviour have studied for years and years and years, probably over 50 years, that actually in the jays, they're actually keeping track of what their partner wants and are trying to give it to them, which I think is actually quite a sweet message for Valentine's Day. Pay attention to your special someone and give them the mealworms that they desire, or the wax moths.
Or stay single forever and eat everything.
Yeah, you can have all of the wax moths then. That's what I tell myself. So following on from this, we are discussing the science of love, the science of romance. And so after this break, I'll be passing over to Dan. So what are you going to tell us about, Dan?
I'm going to talk about love and animals, whether it exists, what is it, what is love?
Baby, don't hurt me. Indeed. So we'll be right back after this break.
And we're back. Welcome back to Fact Naturally, the science show from St. Andrews. And the first thing we're going to talk about today is, of course, love, being Valentine's Day, as David said. And first, I wanted to talk about, well, animals. Can animals feel love? I'd like to think that my pet dog loves me. I'd like to think my old pet cat who died loved me. But can animals actually feel love? But first, to describe, well, whether animals have love or complex emotions like that, you have to sort of summarize what we mean by that in humans from a physiological point of view.
Dan, what is love?
Baby, don't hurt me.
Don't hurt me.
No more. What is
love? I seriously want to know what love is.
And I want you to show me. I want to know what love
is. You guys are idiots. All right, let's move on. In humans, they say that biologically there's three distinct phases of love, love researchers, which exist. There's three distinct types of love in humans. First is the first phase, chronologically, is lust, which is when you just get a real shine for a man or a woman. There's an influx of sex hormones, testosterone and estrogen every time you see or contact the person. This lasts for a couple of weeks up to a couple of months. That's the lust period. Everybody, I would hope, knows what the lust period is.
In physiology, we call that wanting to do it.
Fair enough. And just past that lust phase, which many people don't get past, you two.
Aww.
There's attraction. Attraction's a little different from lust. So lust is just the base concept, I think, of wanting to screw. Attraction is sort of the neuroscience behind falling in love, when you really want to spend a lot of time with a person, just after the first initial phase of a relationship, when you can't really stop thinking about a person. That's the neuroscience behind that, and the endocrinology behind that includes a lot of pheromone excretion, dopamine, adrenaline rushes, things like this when you see a person. Leads to side effects like increased heart rate, loss of appetite, and sleep. I know I'm the most romantic guy here to be reading this list off this way.
I don't know, it's doing the
love
job.
Love you, baby.
Slower.
After the attraction phase. So the attraction phase is said to last anywhere from a few months up to a year, or perhaps even 3 years in longer cases. And then after that, you get into what David referred to as the pair bonding phase.
Very romantically, I might add.
Do you take this man for a long-term pair bond? And that's the attachment phase. And the attachment phase is sort of when all the love and lust sort of dies down a bit, but you're attached. That's the marriage phase, the boring marriage phase.
So they're kind of partnered.
Yeah, phase. That partnered off phase for the rest of your life sort of phase.
Suddenly you can become a stand-up comedian and just talk about your marriage phase.
Yeah, the differences between dating sex and marriage sex. These things sort of
there
have
is
a...
none of the latter. am I right, fellas?
Yeah, well, hey. None of us are married, though. But
two of us are single.
Am That's I right, true. Fellas?
I can tell you, though, that lust phase is really something, boys.
That was the creepiest thing Dan's ever said to us.
Moving on, the attachment phase. The attachment phase is accompanied by a loss or a decrease in sort of the circulating testosterone and the hormones attached or in the attraction phase. The attachment has increases in some chemicals like oxytocin and vasopressin, and there's pair bonding. So that's what happens in humans. The question I wanted to ask, getting around to it, is can animals actually feel this complex type of emotion? So there's a difference. There's a distinction made in animal research between basic emotions, which is fear, anger, and complex human emotions, which we describe as jealousy, sympathy, love, things like this. And so I was going to ask you two boys, can animals, not from personal experience, can animals feel love?
I'm assuming that we're going to split this by discipline.
Yes, right? Probably.
So I'll start with the boring part. If you want to, it's all about how you define it, right? So a lot of the definitions you were talking about were the neuroscience and endocrinology behind it, or the hormones. And if you're going to define it from a hormonal profile perspective, or even patterns of activity across the brain, then you probably could make the argument that on those specific levels, animals are capable of physiologically, animals are physiologically capable of boosting testosterone in the presence of conspecifics or other animals of the same species. The problem is that hormones are just such a labile thing. So stuff like oxytocin and vasopressin, for example, are released in really select parts of the brain and act on very other specific targets. So there's a bit more evidence behind them. But there is like a really big fiasco, especially with oxytocin in the news, where it's kind of been mislabeled as a love hormone. But it's kind of just like an anthropomorphism and a misunderstanding of
the animal. You mean it's not really research. A cuddle drug, which is why...
Well, I've been injecting it in myself daily, and I'm still dead alone.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, that's true.
And actually, it says here it's associated with the attachment phase, which is sort of the boring pair bond phase.
Well, but it also can be attachment with parents, too.
That's true.
So this is the thing, is that if you're talking about a lot of hormones, especially something like testosterone, is that kind of stuff modulates wildly throughout the day even. So identifying something like such that could be as complex as we think as love, and just associating it with some hormone levels that increase for a whole multitude of other factors makes it really difficult. Whereas if you define it by more kind of thought and cognitive processes, I'm assuming this is where David is going
to go. Yeah, kind of. Because I agree with Zach. I mean, to take another way, in terms of what exactly we mean by love, and the definition is that we could also say that love is actually, as Dan said, cognitively complex. And one thing that comes from that is when we think about love, the feeling of being in love, the feeling of even lust and attraction, it feels like more than the surge of chemicals. And the reason for this is that we're subjectively experiencing it. And what is an interesting fact in humans is that we can have dissociate between the kind of emotions happening and us being aware of them. So the subjective state is all about being aware of these emotions. So in the same way that Freud and all these people postulated ages ago that there were unconscious memories and unconscious desires and stuff, that actually is now good experience from, probably is actually involved in fMRI research or something like that, you can induce emotional states in people without them being consciously aware of them. So in the same way that I would say that in terms of the neuroscience stuff, maybe the animals are experiencing a very similar neuroscience,
like sensation.
Exactly. The chemicals in terms of what's going on. But whether that leads to the subjective awareness, the conscious awareness of the feeling of love, which is what it kind of is all about for us when we're thinking about love, is a more difficult question. I think the answer is probably yes, and it's probably quite different, and it's different throughout the animal kingdom. But in terms of asking that question, in terms of being able to, it's a very difficult question, because unlike neurotransmitters, hormones, and other things like that, we are not very good at directly observing these kind of states. When we work on humans, to directly observe these states, we ask them about it. And there have been some studies done on kind of awareness in animals, but they're really kind of at a very early stage and not quite ready to tackle these kind of big emotional sides of things yet.
So you're drawing a distinction between the reactions that happen in love,
yeah,
and the concepts or acknowledging that you're in love.
Yes, kind of. The conscious experience of love.
Yeah, if you imagine something like, if you were talking about like an adrenaline surge or something like that, it's an adrenaline surge. You can measure things like excitability and how much an animal moves around and how excitable and how much we would move around in that kind of state. But aside from that, in a love context, we clearly feel something else that's very different.
Yes, exactly. Anyone who's ever, had, for example, a panic attack. I mean, there's a large adrenaline surge in panic attack.
Which the best kind of love.
Which is incredibly unpleasant. However, if you wanted to go to a scary film or go on a roller coaster, some people love that and they get off on the adrenaline thrill. So there is, you can have these kind of hormonal reactions, but they can be interpreted subjectively quite different ways. Or as I was saying, sometimes not even at all.
So when a young teenager first experiences love and he says, is this love, is this love, is this love, is this love that I'm feeling? Is this love, is this love, is this love, is this love that I'm feeling? Oh,
you
no,
can
it's a
say
panic attack.
Yes, but it also might be some kind of state of physiological arousal brought on through a panic attack that is being misappropriated into love. Whereas Zach was talking about the difference of exactly defining when these hormones come up and the fact that you can't easily ascribe hormone to something that's complicated.
Okay, on that then, we've been talking about, in general, animals. Sticking to a physiological point of view, in the hierarchy of cognitive thought amongst animals, where would you draw a line between animals that could possibly feel love and those that don't?
It's kind of like, yeah, like to answer this kind of question well, we would have to understand more about it, right? Like, so if you talk about, if you want to get down again to like the nitty-gritty physiology of it, and you're talking about hormones, it's like there are evolutionary patterns in what types of hormones and analogs in birds. For example, birds, mainly in terms of a stress hormone, they have corticosterone, whereas we predominantly have cortisol, even though both birds and us have both corticosterone and cortisol in our blood, just in totally different levels, and different hormones playing the same role. So even down at the physiological basis, there can be completely different mechanisms, but whether or not that means, you know, again, this crazy subjective experience outside of these basic chemical rushes are felt similarly in totally different brains or totally different systems, I think that's well beyond my small puny brain.
David, your thoughts?
What is love?
I think it then comes down to, yeah, so it can be tricky because I think in terms of what is love, I can see there being variation. So in terms of thinking about animal cognition generally that doesn't tend to deal with these emotional states, we see there are some things that are very widespread and there are some things that are kind of more specific adaptations in particular ecologies, and there's other things that vary with how related you are. So I think it's probably going to be the same with this, right? Though I don't, it is possible, and there are people out there that argue that the capacity to kind of feel things subjectively is all tied up with language. So these people would argue that no animals feel this. Some of these people even argue that pre-verbal children, so infants, do not feel anything.
And we just anthropomorphize their reactions to things.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
So it is very difficult to kind of get an idea of what an animal is feeling without anthropomorphizing, because that's all we have to go on at the moment, right? And we are anthropomorphizing machines. We get angry with the toaster because it's holding back on us. So it can be, so it is very tricky.
Damn that watch, Paul.
I think in terms of a basic one, in terms of like a feeling, like a kind of thing, scaling it back to liking and not liking as a kind of very simple one, it's probably really very widespread. Like I said, whether the subjective feeling that goes on that is the same, what that feels like, I don't know. It's interesting, but it's a really difficult question to ask.
So let me put you two boys on the spot. Does your pet dog or cat, not your pet fish, dog or cat, love you? Go.
I have like horribly biased like opinions on this that have no founding in science, so they shouldn't be taken as such. But I always thought like the best was those YouTube videos where you always see like the war veterans coming back,
right,
and their dog sees them for the first time, and it's just like insane. Like it's just all over and won't stop leaving them alone and stuff. But I have no actual serious opinion on this.
I don't know. It's kind of difficult. So I definitely think that the cat. I have two cats at home. I think one of them has definitely formed quite a strong attachment to my brother. And when my brother left home, this is another anecdote, so I've become a massive hypocrite. So when my brother left home, this cat sat in the window meowing away for days. So it's kind of difficult because with my pure science hat on, I don't think so. Not necessarily that I don't think it. What I don't think is I don't think it's feeling exactly what we feel, right? I don't know, and I am agnostic towards what it is feeling, but I don't think it's feeling what we do feel. However, just on a social day to day sort of thing, yeah, I have no problem with describing the fact that my cat was in love with my brother. As weird as that, creepy as that sounds.
I wanted to say, too, just this is probably the best time, or as good a time as any, is that in this podcast, we're going to use a lot of words like intelligent and love. And we've even talked in the previous podcast that we think intelligence is probably, obviously this very human-centric definition. And we're going to use it in passing, because we're not going to want to dissect it every time we bring it up. Mm. And it's for accessibility purposes. Mm. So just remember that a lot of these words we use are very human-centric.
Especially as we're in quite a meaty biology section, as is the whole topic this week. The question in biology is always, I think you'll find it's a little more complicated than that. Mm. So,
speaking of meaty biology, Zach is up next.
So just a little teaser. Coming up after the break, I will be talking about what I think is probably one of the biggest myths about a lot of the science of love, and that is all the work on pheromones, specifically working, eventually building up to pheromones in humans, and what is actually out there in terms of what it means. All right, see you soon. And welcome back for this episode on love. I thought I would talk about something that seems to be a bit of a myth or a lot of folk science support behind it, and that is the concept of pheromones, and ultimately pheromones in humans. But I'm just going to give a little bit of background first, talk about some animal experiments, and then I only have this short block, but I am trying to make a direct beeline to getting right to those interesting questions as to whether or not pheromones will get you laid. So I'm looking out for everybody.
Aw. Doing the Lord's work, Zach.
I am. So pheromones, if you don't know, are chemical substances that are released outside of the body that can influence basically behaviors or physiological processes in other individuals. So the actual concept of a pheromone was first introduced in 1959 when Peter Carlson and Martin Luscher named it. And they named it based off some Greek words. We got pheron, which is to transport. And then we have hormone, which is to stimulate. So hormones were already named by then, obviously. It's actually not that old. It's not that old of a concept in science. But obviously with pheromones, is you're getting this novel form of transport where you're actually, your chemicals are affecting someone else.
When was it from? Because you think pheromones have been around for a long time.
1959.
And
in that same publication, they actually ID'd the first pheromone, which was bombacol. I think I pronounced that correctly, which is released. They work on invertebrates. And bombacol is a pheromone released by female silk moths, and it's an airborne kind of pheromone, and they use it to attract mates. So they release it into an air, and then males come. And since then, we've had many different pheromones characterized in non-human animals. So for the next little segment, I'm going to talk about four major effects, and these have been kind of very robust, well-tested, and isolated right down to specific compounds and pheromones. So these are kind of, I would argue, they're good evidence of pheromones, and they're kind of physiological effects, too. But they have a little bit of sex to them. Yeah, I'm trying to spice it up. I'm sorry. This is as hot as my physiology gets.
Well, it's okay. You got that deep, bassy voice.
So the first is the Liebut effect. And you may have heard of this, and we're going to revisit this in a second. But basically, the Liebut effect was the first kind of pheromone effect. And it was found when some researchers found that the social environment actually had effects on the estrus, or menstruation cycle, in rodents. So basically, they found that when you group housed female mice and you put four of them in the same cage, over time, all of their estrus cycles would actually extend. They would get longer, but then they would synchronize. And eventually what they found was this could actually be replicated entirely just by a pheromone that is in female's urine. Yeah, that's right. I came back to urine.
Yay!
Just Max Weekly urine segment.
Just when you thought you could get rid
every
of me.
Week.
And so let's talk more about urine. A lot of these effects are urine. Spoiler okay. alert. So to build on top of the Leboot effect, so this is just the concept of a bunch of different female mice living in the same spot will eventually synchronize their estrous cycles. So what happens then if you expose those same females to a male? Well, you get the Witten effect. So if you then expose these synchronized females to a male, despite where in the actual estrous cycle they are, they will all begin ovulating and being sexually receptive within 3 to 4 days. So all of a sudden they'll break out of it and become sexually receptive for a male. Mm-hmm. And then they found, of course, this could be entirely replicated by just exposing females to male urine, and then even broke it down further into actually finding specific pheromones. And a lot of these are steroid hormones that you just find in the urine. So a lot of times hormones are actually also acting as pheromones.
This is all in rodents, right?
Yeah, this is all just rodent work, which is probably the most robust and replicated effect.
But also, I mean, it makes sense because rodents urinate all over the place, don't they?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah.
And so you'd expect to find it in humans, too.
Yeah, especially drunken humans.
That's you, pheromone effects of R. Kelly. I believe I can fly. I believe I can touch the sky. I don't know if we can keep that in.
What's the adaptive function of a synchronized menstrual cycle? What's the point of that?
I was under the impression, and this is not 100%, so sadly I don't know as much about this as I'm pretending, but I was always under the impression that actually a lot of it is suppression. So females are trying to suppress the other females' estrous cycles to try and lower their receptivity. So if a male ever does come, they'll be receptive in the first to mate.
Yeah.
So I'm going to apologize for the next effect because it's the goriest. But it has to be done, I feel. And this just shows how science-y I am. This is the Bruce effect. Also, I would never want this effect named after me. So this is an effect where basically a novel male doesn't want... I'll just explain it and then we'll figure it out. So this happens if you house a pregnant female mouse with a novel male. So not the father.
Oh, God, mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what happens is a pheromone in the male's actual urine can, not always, but it can, and this is the effect, can stimulate miscarriage in the female and a speedy return to ovulation and sexual receptivity, again, within 3 to 4 days. So this is the male actually blocking the birth of some other male's offspring to enable himself to then mate with the female and have his own offspring.
Similar effect to a male lion performing infanticide on another female's baby to bring them to
And the infanticide is also seen in mice as well. Mm. So that's especially, and it's quite creepy. If you see this as a case of sexual conflict as well, in which evolution, there's the male and the female want different things. And this is obviously the male's got the upper hand at this particular point in time.
Welcome to our episode on love, ladies and gentlemen.
Killing babies, yeah, fact naturally.
Happy Valentine's Day.
Like I said, I wanted to talk about these because these are the ones I was always taught are kind of classic examples of pheromones, and they're just so like robust and well known and well described at this point. And the last of the four I wanted to talk about is the Vandenberg effect. And this is kind of a neat effect. Again, this is something we'll probably come back to. And this is where you take an immature, so a sexually immature, female rat, and you expose them to an adult male for 20 days. And just the exposure, and eventually, again, this comes down to pheromones, the actual pheromone exposure will actually speed up the development of that immature female, and she'll reach sexual maturity faster than a female rat that never was exposed to an adult male.
Yeah.
So you get these four kind of robust, really interesting effects. And that's all and great, but this is a podcast episode about love, and so we're not going to talk about it and rats and mice because they do all messed up stuff and pee on each other all the time.
So does R. Kelly.
I think about it every night and day.
And surely there cannot be love where there is urine. And that explains so much of my history. So let's move on to pheromones in humans. So I'm going to start off by saying this is like a horribly controversial and mixed evidence field. I was looking for really up-to-date scientific reviews on the idea, and I can find equally modern ones that have exactly opposite opinions, where there's some find really good evidence for it in some things, and others find no evidence. So there are some robust effects, but we'll get that in a second. So first, where do you guys think the human pheromones are?
In the heart.
Closer to the heart.
We wish. It's wishful thinking. It'd be very difficult to get out of the body from there, though.
The armpits.
David is correct.
Oh.
It's called the axilla, if you want to get all medical. So we think, again, this is like a most likely thing, is that if we have these pheromones and they're acting that way, they're probably coming from the armpits, Better than that, I found a scientific review that called armpits the quote-unquote ideal site of pheromone secretion.
Oh.
Do you want to know why?
Because I don't... Hair.
So hair is one. So by having hair, you increase the surface area for dispersal into the air of your pheromones. Because armpits are very warm, you can get increased transmission of the samples basically into a gas or volatilization. But just basically that the pheromones can get vaporized and go into the air a lot easier in a warmer region of the body. One of them, which you probably aren't going to guess, is just that there's a good combination of glands there. You've got the eccrine, apocrine, and sebaceous glands, all contributing to those wonderful smells.
What about, because it's an armpit, it's like a lever, right? You okay. might have to stick with me for this.
Yep.
So
I'm on board.
It can kind of, while your arm is down, it's kind of enclosed and can brew up some pheromones so that when your arm lifts up, the suction will disperse them out.
Oh, beautiful.
Into the thing, and you'll get, rather than a constant secretion of hormones, the movement of the arms will create wafts.
See, I was always under the impression that you'd get that suction because there's sexual selection for just how sexy it is when you make that farting sound with your hand cupped under your arm.
That's true. But your hand's cupped under your arm, so do the pheromones escape, or do they just move to your hand?
Does that make the chicken dance like a mating ritual, then?
Yep. Exactly.
Actually, I kind of want you guys to keep trying to guess, because the last one of these reasons as to why the armpit is such a great place for pheromones to come from is actually pretty guessable, well, potentially guessable. And David's, like, kind of on the right idea. It's almost a mechanical thing, but not really. Think about where the armpit is.
It's within a region other people may bury their face when they're sleeping.
Very close.
It's near your heart.
When you're standing up... The armpit is close to the nose level of the recipient. But if we had these pheromones, where do you think we would detect them?
By the nose.
So the olfactory system?
Yeah. The tongue?
So it's actually somewhat almost of a combination between the two. It's actually...
You didn't have much options.
Yeah, exactly.
The ears.
So it's really well studied in mammals where they actually, as to how they actually sense pheromones in the air. And it's through a distinct organ called the vomeronasal organ, which is actually largely embedded in your olfactory or your smell system. And it's actually near. So basically with your smell system, you have odorant molecules or odors coming in through your nose, and they actually attach to receptors just kind of on a sheet called the epithelium. It's just a sheet of receptors, basically. And you see the exact same thing with the vomeronasal organ. Although, if I'm not mistaken, particles can come in through the mouth and then kind of recycle back up into the nose, too. And that's kind of how you detect flavor as well.
The cavity between the mouth and the nose.
Yeah. So the vomeronasal organ is there. Now, part of the reason why a lot of this pheromone sensation stuff in humans is so controversial is because, so the vomeronasal organ, it projects to part of the brain called the, I think it's accessory olfactory bulb. So we have this big distinct part of the brain called the olfactory bulb, and that's just involved in smell. So all the smell information goes there and then goes into the brain. But it actually distinct from that, but right beside it, there's an accessory olfactory bulb involved in pheromone signaling or pheromone response to signal, I guess, response or perception. However, humans have a vomeronasal organ, but it looks like it doesn't actually go anywhere. We don't actually have the part of the brain it projects to. Also, all genetic and anatomical studies suggest that it's entirely non-functional.
So it'd be vestigial, like the appendix.
Exactly, yeah. So it's a vestigial thing. So it's there probably as a product of evolution, but doesn't actually have
the
function.
I think the appendix now does something useful. So it's vestigial. I'm sure, like, yeah. It's vestigial like something else.
It's vestigial.
A tailbone.
The tailbone, yeah.
Yeah, that's a good one. Actually, yeah, and there's some evidence that during development, the fetus actually, I think, actually expresses some of the receptors in the vomeronasal organ. So it might actually be involved in triggering some developmental processes in utero. But once you get out of there, it looks like it's non-functional.
Speaking of fetuses and vestigial, gills.
Gills
and fetuses. There you go.
You guys don't still have your gills?
Well, not on me.
Oh. We're not supposed to talk about it anyway.
Mine have been bronzed and are on the mantelpiece.
So basically the big assumption is that if we do detect pheromones, we're just detecting them through the olfactory system. There's some other kind of adaptations to it. So, if you remember some of our effects we were talking about in rodents, the big question is, do we see any of those in humans? And don't worry, I'm not going to talk about the miscarriage one. So the first one is the Liebut effect, and you may have heard of this. So the Liebut effect, again, is the menstrual synchrony. And the most famous study of this was actually kind of, I don't know if it was like an incidental study or not, but basically researchers found that female college students that would actually live together would synchronize their menstrual cycles over time, just over time of living together. And they replicated this using, I was taught this in social psychology in undergrad, and I was always taught of it as the essence of Guinevere study.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
So the way that they test a lot of this pheromone stuff in humans is beautifully. I love it. It's like the best procedure. So basically, they get a bunch of guys or girls to come in, depending on whose pheromones you want, and they tape absorbent pads to your armpits, and they get you to either just walk around for the day or actually actively run or sweat. And then they take those pads back, and then they dab them on the upper lips of subjects. Hey.
Sign me up.
Hey, just be happy that we're not dealing with urine anymore. I wish. So basically what they found was, outside of this anecdotal evidence where these females that were living together would synchronize their menstrual cycles, they actually showed that they could replicate it. So they took some subject, a driver, they called it, Guinevere, and they took her sweat. So they took her potential source of pheromones, and they dabbed it on the upper lip of a bunch of different volunteer females. Volunteers! Mm-hmm. There's some sick people out there.
That probably biases the study somehow, right?
Yeah. So they dabbed it on the upper lip for 3 times a week over 4 months, and by the end of the 4 months, all of the volunteers had synchronized their menstrual cycles to the original driving subject without ever having met them. So they never actually had any interaction.
So there's an effect.
So, yeah, there's an effect, and it's entirely because of BO, or some pit juice. Can we call it that? Scientific name, pit juice.
So do you think you could negate this by, if you were a female college student and you were sharing a room with someone else, if one of you was ultra mega clean, you had to be both ultra mega clean, would this not happen?
Yeah, so this is one of the big confounds of studying pheromone effects in humans, is that most of us tend to like to be kind of clean.
You don't speak for everyone.
So I should say, though, if you think about the other effect I was talking about with the Whiten effect, so if you've got the synchronous system set up, what happens when you introduce a male, right? So if you remember in the rodents, they kind of try to, the females speed up towards being sexually receptive and ovulating so that they can mate. So what happens is, what happens if you take male armpit sweat and dab it on the upper lip of females? You want me to talk slower, more details?
No, keep going.
Well, actually, it's not necessarily the same as the Whiten effect, but we do see a regulatory effect. So one study reported that they took a bunch of females, and they took females that were had the most abhorrent estrous cycles, so ones that were suspiciously long or far too short, and they exposed those, as well as controls, the females that were kind of right on what you'd expect, and they exposed them all to males' armpit sweat dabbed on their upper lips, and what they actually found were males that had a regulatory effect, so they would actually shorten extra long cycles and lengthen shorter cycles, so they're actually normalizing a lot of these apparent cycles.
Okay.
That's probably a kind of a nice
thing. So men serve a useful function after all.
Some, yeah. Regulating parts of us do. Stuff that comes out of our armpits does.
Yeah.
We can either regulate or stop menstrual cycles.
So this is where things get a little weirder.
That's how I advertise myself on the internet.
And so people have provided some kind of anecdotal evidence of some of these other effects. And probably the most famous of that is the Vandenberg effect, which is the acceleration to sexual maturity.
Uh-huh.
Right? So introducing a sexually immature rodent female and just exposing her to an adult male, just exposure, and especially the exposure to the pheromone, will actually speed up her development so that she reaches sexual maturity faster. So there is one study that's just kind of an anecdotal study, but girls who live with a stepfather in the house actually reach puberty sooner.
Yeah. Age of monarchy, they call it. Sexual receptivity, yep.
However, it's obviously very tough to dissect other effects in that situation, and there's obviously plenty of ethical issues when now you're talking about, I'm going to dab armpit sweat on your nose, that could affect when you reach puberty.
Yeah, and a possible confound to that, so I've read this one. A girl raised by a stepfather, you might liken to, I don't want to take shot at stepparents or anything like this, you might liken that to a child who's raised in a non-optimal environment. So just as an animal who's raised in sort of a dangerous environment might reach sexual receptivity faster in order to have an increased possibility of mating, there is the confound that could be happening in humans. It's not just the effect of a non-biological father. So there's that confound in that.
Yeah, well, the concept of something like an optimal environment for being raised in humans is just ridiculous. It's kind of
no, I mean, there's effects of...
Why do you hate step-parents?
I don't.
Well, there is some... I remember reading some evolutionary psychology work in which they were likening step-parents to those lions, the infanticide lions. And there did seem to be an effect in the step-parents... the infant mortality was much more likely with step-parents than non-step-parents when the children were under the age of two. And this was put up to be this kind of evolutionary continuity, same as mice, same as, and it's still, one that stresses, can't stress this enough, it was still very, very rare. So by it being much more likely, it's the equivalent of like one case in 100,000 to 50 cases in 100,000.
Yeah, right? Threefold the increase.
So it was a big effect, but it's still very, very rare. That said, I remember talking about this with someone at the time, and they said, actually, it might also be the case of that the mother might, if a mother who has a stepfather come in and she's got children under the age of two, maybe like he might be a bit of a douche. Was one of the things that grow up. He might not
to be scientific.
She might not have made the best choice of what a best choice in mate, as it were, and it might actually more reflect that than anything.
Well, before we punish people for their choices in life. let me continue on, because I finally reached the apex of my segment, or you could say the climax of my segment.
Ugh.
Hey, ladies. So, we finally got there. We've talked about pheromones, what they are, we've talked about them in animals, we talked about even some robust physiological, these are all kind of physiological effects in humans, I haven't talked anything about really behavior. So, let's talk about the potential role of pheromones in sexy behaviors.
Yay!
So there are some studies, and this is where things get really back and forth with replications not working out or other manipulations suggesting the opposite, that there is a role and that there
isn't a role.
Everything
up to now has been pretty robust. Okay.
And it's stuff that's really easy to measure, like measuring things.
Lay it on us.
Okay, so there's two wonderful complementary studies that I just thought would be really fun to talk about, and I'm not saying anything besides what exactly they are. I'm not going to comment anything else aside from that. So the best evidence comes from two studies that are on synthetic hormones or synthetic pheromones, looking at sociosexual behaviors in males and females. So the male study came first. It was by Cutler and company, and it was a bunch of male volunteers basically got different... they either got a control, they had a placebo, so they were told that they were given a synthetic pheromone, but it wasn't actually, it was just something innocuous. Or they were actually given the synthetic hormone added to their aftershave. So aftershave that they were using, I think it was like every couple days at least, if not sooner. And then they would keep a self-report journal of the sexy things they do. That's what I wrote down. there were six sociosexual behaviors, I believe. And the big finding of this one was that in the pheromone group, 58% of individuals reported an increase in sexual intercourse and sleeping with a romantic partner, whereas in the placebo condition, it was only 19% of participants.
Oh. Were they single, these people? Were they already in
relationships? Well, so I'll get back to that in a second. So keep that in mind, because now we're going to go to the female study.
We're taking notes, right?
So this is a complementary study, and it is a very complementary study, because it's basically the same study but in females.
Yeah.
Except for not with aftershave. So this is by McCoy and Pinto. And so they had female volunteers keep a journal of the exact same six sociosexual behaviors. And they didn't have a placebo condition, but they had a control. And they had a synthetic pheromone condition. It was a female pheromone this time, added to their perfume that they would use on a daily basis. And what they found was in the pheromone group, after correcting for the fact that the exposure to the pheromone can actually change the ovulation cycle, and that depending on where you are in your menstrual cycle, that might obviously affect if you're having sex or if you're going on dates and stuff like that, or it could have a confound. So after correcting for that, they found that the pheromone-treated group had an increase in, or a higher proportion of them, increased the amount of sex they were having and the number of formal dates they were going on.
Huh.
So they had complementary findings in the male and female study with at least the amount of sex they were having. To answer your question... no. there's a lot of obvious problems with this kind of study, and one of the biggest ones is they actually didn't account for relationship status, as far as I can tell. I was only reading a review on it, but they definitely mentioned that they didn't account for it, which is whether or not you're married. You might have no sex. Am I right, guys?
Damn that attachment
face.
Oh,
damn. Live at the improv with yuck, Zach Hall.
Yuck. Get her done. So obvious,
he just likes to make people laugh.
So there's some other major problems with this kind of stuff. One of the biggest ones is self-report.
Yeah.
So these people were keeping a journal. And I would literally say that I had sex like thousands of times a day in my journal if they wouldn't question it.
we had a great one. I was talking to a friend of ours who has worked with these socio-sexual surveys, and one of the questions is, over the next 5 years, how many sex partners do you think you'll have? And it's supposed to be very quantifiable. And she was sick of people writing in, as many as will have me.
Yeah, gross. Third major problem with these studies specifically is, it's kind of a mean problem, is that there is no control for attractiveness.
Mm.
So that's my bit on pheromones. Mm-hmm. So again, humans are a really controversial thing, especially when you're talking about like the real edgy behaviors and the things. And this is like a multi-billion-dollar industry where people are putting synthetic pheromones into things with no real evidence or no solid evidence that it works. All right, so that was the end. So like I said, there's some really neat, robust physiological effects. So pheromones are a thing. It's just when you hear them affecting things like attractiveness and stuff like that, take it with a grain of salt. But there's plenty out there, and there's plenty more still being done.
Don't waste your money.
Rodents, as far as I can tell, love doing it.
And we're back. So, we're finally on to my section. And as I hinted before the break, we're going to look at what makes someone attractive. Surely a useful thing to know around Valentine's Day. Now, previously when we've been talking about attractiveness, we think about attractiveness as almost an objective quality. There is such a thing as someone who is attractive, and they would make a desirable mate for your pair bond. I'm keep using the romantic language that I started with. However, how objective actually is this standard? I mean, is there an objective standard of attractiveness out there, or do we each kind of experience what is attractive individually? Or what kind of... I think the answer is probably going to be a little bit of both. As we said, if there is one rule in biology, it's always that things are always a little bit more complicated than they first appear.
You clearly haven't seen my beard if you have to question whether or not there is an objective beauty.
But yeah, I mean, in terms of thinking about faces, where there's a lot of work has been done on this, there are some kind of effects that have been kind of consistently found with people. I think Dan, this is what Dan works on, so I was going to... That's that right, Dan?
There are tons. So in terms of objective attractiveness, there's not one ideal objective. And males looking at females, well, in female attractiveness, there's a lot less variance in what's perceived as attractive. So most guys or homosexual women can look at a group of girls and pick approximately the same woman who would be the most attractive of the group. Looking the other way around, that's not quite the same for women or homosexual men looking at men. The variance in what's attractive in a man is a lot greater than that's attractive in a woman.
So I did read at one point, men and women look for different things in partners, right? So men rank physical attractiveness more highly and women rank it as well as other things such as resources, stability of their job, and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and so from a very basic background of just sort of simple sexual selection, men were the breadwinners, the hunters, the gatherers. Well, just the hunters anyway. They're the bigger, stronger ones, the resource earners, the protectors. But what the woman was there for was was nurturing and basically bringing up babies and keeping the brood.
I'm so glad I don't have to say this bit.
This is not an anti-feminist slant. This is not today's culture. This is I ain't saying she a gold digger. Just a simple
background. Saying that this might have resulted in them having preferences for different types of things.
Well, not quite different types of things, but just emphasis on different bits of attractiveness. Yeah,
so they all find these things important, but they rank them differently?
Yes. So if you're thinking about it from that point of view, the woman's main role in society was to give birth to the offspring and to care for the child. Thinking about the best outcome for a child, you would want to have an attractive woman giving birth to the child. The genes get passed on. A woman's point of view, looking at a man, you have to have a man who's more masculine, a bit stronger, can earn a little bit more resources, or nowadays money. So there's the resource aspect. But through the underlying sort of hormones and phenotypes that leads to a big, strong, masculine man, that also seems to lead to some very negative personality types.
Yeah.
So it's always the big, masculine man. Not always. I don't want to get anybody mad at me. But typically, the big,
masculine man. I'm not mad at you because I am the big, masculine man, Dan.
The big, masculine man. The kind of guy who can protect you. The kind of guy who can, who does, even today, earn more money. More ambitious, things like this. Also, more aggressive, more likely to cheat, more likely to hit a woman, more likely to do a whole bunch of very negative things. And so there's that negative personality type to to take into account, and so a woman might not want to go for the most masculine and at most phenotypically attractive. Tail off that and take into account personality.
So there's a trade-off.
There's a trade-off that way.
Excellent. So yeah, I mean, because I remember picking up reading about the, you know, they, the things that they they'd look for, and it doesn't necessarily imply anything about the way that they see their partners necessarily. And I mean, their roles and the thing. This is just in terms of what they're finding attractive.
Yes. Yeah.
Because I mean, there was a study that if this was true. So gay men also found ranked physical attractiveness higher, just as straight,
I love his books.
Straight men did. Right. Pardon?
I love his books.
looks. So they also ranked. So it's just it was a male thing to do this.
Yeah.
But okay, so there is obviously these overarching ideas of attractiveness and all this kind of stuff. However, people tend to find someone. There is someone multiple someones out there for someone, for everyone, we hope. So is this due to
night, I hope, into my pillow until I can fall asleep.
That's too much information, dude. also, it's weird to call it hope. But there is... So is this due to them compromising, or is actually when we, as Dan kind of hinted, is attractiveness actually slightly different for different people? And if so, where does this come from?
I wouldn't say it's a compromise in such that people consciously think of a trade-off, but there are individual differences in preferences. So
that's what I meant. Rather than the compromises, rather than you will not be able to achieve this.
Yeah.
Everyone agrees who is attractive, and you will not be able to achieve this person.
Sure.
So you compromise for someone further down.
So let's take a look at women looking at men again. Let's say every woman, even if they could objectively pick out which guys are the best looking ones, I told you how maybe phenotypically the more masculine and maybe the better looking ones were not personally all that great. One of those off or bad traits is infidelity. And there's a chance that a masculine guy could impregnate a woman and then take off and not provide for the offspring, anything like this. Mm-hmm. So one thing that they do find is that a woman, and it's true for men looking at women as well, this gets really mean. People who are maybe less attractive or...
on these objective measures.
Yeah, people who maybe can't retain the top quality of success member do tend to show strength and preferences for slightly less good-looking or sounding people. Mm-hmm. So one study in Voices...
But this is also still involves that objective idea of what is good-looking, right?
Yes. So, for instance...
But is it they're compromising for something lower, or is that now what
they're...
Or is
that actually what they're finding attractive?
That's actually, they have a strengthened preference for.
So that is their preference.
That is, they have a shifted preference. Yeah.
So that's what they find attractive.
Yeah, so I'm looking at it from a point of view of less attractive people like less attractive people like. Mm. And that's from a sort of different point of view. You could say there's something or someone for everyone, and people line up. They do align in terms of attractiveness and things like this, yeah.
So if I'm not mistaken, then... The reason I'm single is just because I'm like that really attractive one. People think I'm mean or something like that, or
it's
they're all just
like,
or they just assume they can't attain.
Zach
me.
Is in the top 0.3%, and there's just and so this town's
just,
not big enough.
They just assume that they can't get me, and they lower their standards.
This comes out. I mean, there is there's an awful lot of work that's been done on the role of similarity in attraction. So in this case, that would actually kind of fit with that. If you had a similar, if there was such a thing as an objective level of attractiveness, and you were similar to your partner on that, then you would be a more stable match, and you would go out.
Yeah, from the empirical background, if you rate a bunch of people for attractiveness, you do find that there's correlations between the attractiveness of people who pair up. If you think about this, I don't want to plant the seed of thought in anybody's mind, but if you think about the couples that you know, I tend to find that people I know who are together tend to look alike. If you think about romantic couples that you know, they do tend to look a little bit alike. Now, part of that could be what they call the mirror exposure effect. So people always think that they're a little bit more attractive, and they see themselves in the mirror constantly. They can hear their own voice constantly, and they get used to that sort of thing. It's the familiarity effect that you can get with a lot of non-human objects too. You just tend to like things that you see a lot, and so there's probably an influence of you tend to like things that look like you because you see a lot of yourself. You know, people who look like you sort of like that too. But there's also the line of theory that's People will just line up on in terms of attractiveness. Yeah.
So this kind of matching hypothesis, it extends beyond just physical attractiveness. It's matching, so it's long-term relationships as a product of those equally matched in attractiveness and were more stable, And so it's not just physical attractiveness, but it's also attitudes and personality. So there's a role for this. However, they also point out there's a role for complementarity, right? So not necessarily, so this is not...
So it's like you date someone whose face perfectly matches with yours when you press them against each other?
Exactly.
So you date someone with the imprint of your face.
We like
on
to call that
face.
The tessellation effect. It makes it very difficult to get there. But basically, this is moving away from physical attractiveness into other areas of attractiveness, other things that you would find attractive. And we're saying that although males and females might weight them differently, they do find all of these different things valuable in making mate choice decisions.
I'm going to briefly stop you. I was talking about women basing attractiveness on men based on resources, things like this. There's more and more evidence that I'm at least hearing about these days in today's culture where men are starting to base a little bit of their attractiveness judgments on women's wealth and women's ability to provide for things.
So as it's kind of even, the culture's evening out.
The demasculinization of men is what some magazines would call it, women are
it's a
more
blow for
and more,
equality.
Well, it's good because at least there's some evening out of the sexes that way.
So another important aspect, as we're saying, is we move away from physical attractiveness is complementarity. So although people might be attracted to other people who share their attitudes or their personality, they might also equally find attractive people with attitudes or personality that complement their own. Mm-hmm. So not necessarily they're similar, but they go well together. So this was phrased as being more... There has been work that's shown that people are more attracted to their ideal self than their actual self.
True, it makes sense if you think about something like if you're in a relationship and there's someone who's kind of more outgoing and you have someone who's really timid. Because when you're at like the restaurant and you just want the waitress to stop, and if it's just two timid people, because I've been there many times, you'll just wait there all night.
These two things aren't necessarily... So they sound like they're different, right? The complement sounds opposite to being similar. But they can actually kind of... Sometimes they predict the same things, and sometimes they might be more important in different realms than others.
From what I understand from the personality matching aspects, a lot of the things that determine your phenotype also determine your personality traits. Mm-hmm. So there is some matching that way, I think, too. It's people who look alike also tend to have the same personality traits, and they will match up. So whether they're basing that on personal looks or on
so this might actually all come together.
Yeah, I think it's yes. Mm-hmm. I think down the line there's probably matching of many attributes, looks and personality and
cool. So just to get away from this kind of Dan's got data that he can talk about so far, I have no data here to discuss it, a big study that's done on this. So this was done 2011, I think. It was a large sample of twins, monozygotic, which are identical twins, and dizygotic, which are non-identical twins. And there's 20,000 participants. That's 10,000 pairs of twins. That took me longer than I should be feel proud of. What they looked at is in both the parents of the twins and in each twin and in each twin's partner, the height... The body mass index, which is the weight, a description of the body shape based on both the weight and the height of the individual, their age, their education, their personality. I think they used
the 5-point personality.
They picked parts of the 5-point personality ones, but they had three of them: income, social attitudes, and religiosity, which I think is the way you pronounce that word.
Yep.
So what did they find? It was a massive correlational study. They found almost no genetic effects on what on choice. You can do this with twin studies because they're monozygotic versus dizygotic. If the identical twins match, but the non-identical twins don't, then you can say this is a genetic thing. So they didn't find any genetic effect on their choices.
On their preferences.
On their preferences for choices. Just to be fair, so when we're talking with what Dan and I were talking about earlier, a lot of work has been done on particularly faces, right? And that's kind of some of the stuff that we were talking about.
Sure.
They specifically, and I'll get back to this, do not talk about faces in this study.
Okay.
So like I said, height, BMI, age, education, personality, income, social attitudes, and religiosity.
This is all things they're basing their preferences on.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, this is the variables that the people looked at. So they,
right, okay.
Okay. And they didn't find any effect of any of these, genetic effect of any of these on matrix. So genetics, in terms of like your choice, it seems that from these, there isn't a kind of genetic determination of what these people were after. They found a family effect, however. So this would be seen in both the dizygotic twins and the monozygotic twins. But I assume not in ones that were adopted, which is another way of looking at this, on the age and income of their partners. So it looked as...
Yeah, when you say that you assume, though, or you, like, do you know if it's an adoption thing or not?
I don't... They said that they had controls for it, so I think there was a couple. But even then, there would be one or two. I think it's probably based on the monozygotic, dizygotic...
Okay.
Thing.
So is it a rearing environment, or is it an actual genetic thing?
No, it's a... It looks... Because the relationship does not seem to be tighter with monozygotic than dizygotic. They say it's probably a rearing environment rather than a genetic thing. It could still be a genetic thing, because they are still twins. They're still siblings. But they're not genetically identical. So they did find an effect of... And it kind of also intuitively makes sense as a rearing environment, because it's determined... well, not determined, but it had an effect on the age and income of their choices.
Okay.
Which would make sense more from a kind of environmental upbringing.
Like nurture versus nature. But
But it makes sense for it's an environmental, something they experienced growing up than any kind of genetic effect.
Welcome to St. Andrews, where rich meet rich.
So they didn't find any effect of sexual imprinting. So sexual imprinting is... matching the phenotype of your parents. So if there was a correlation between their partners and the attributes of their partners and the attributes of the parents, and there might be some argument for phenotype matching there, but they didn't, for imprinting there, but they didn't find any of that. But we'll come back to that in a second. Their main effect was that partners were chosen based on their similarity. So they talked about phenotype matching. So phenotype here just means any of these variables, an aspect of themselves in terms of their behavior or the way they look.
Just a trait.
Yeah, a trait. Yeah, exactly. And so that they were attracted to people who were similar to them, seemingly. Interestingly, they controlled, and I think this is quite nice, they controlled against what's convergence. So convergence is two people... say with differing opinions get together, and over the course of their relationship they come to converge on the same opinions.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And they're controlled by that by looking at the time of the length of the relationships. So the length of the relationships, it would think that they would be more similar the longer they're in the relationships if they were converging, but actually this was found to not be an effect. So it looks as though they were attracted to this the initial point before they kind of start off their relationship, as it were. In terms of what they actually rated, they didn't choose similarity in all things. They chose similarity in education, attitudes, age, and religiousness.
What do they mean by attitudes, though?
So it's a social attitude survey. So their opinions about...
Like major things?
Yeah, they're kind of like political opinions and stuff like that. Interestingly, not the kind of the physical things such as BMI and height.
Was that like on a questionnaire, or did they show them pictures of people?
No, this is an experiment. This is a kind of a questionnaire about
Thing,
right? So it is self-report, so that's got a bit of...
So they just ask, how tall would you prefer your...
How tall is your partner, and what's your BMI of your partner? They did a social attitudes questionnaire. They recorded their education, like what's your highest level of education?
I see.
All this kind of stuff. So they did find stuff, but like I was saying with Dan... While they didn't find any effect of the physical characteristics, the only physical characteristics they looked at were height and BMI.
True.
So these are quite broad and actually...
And BMI doesn't even mean that much anymore.
No, not necessary, no.
According to BMI, George Clooney is obese.
According to BMI, I'm not obese, but I'm pushing
overweight. I'm pretty sure I must be.
Definitely.
Thanks.
So just to get at, so
according
to
my BMIs, you look obese.
So they, first of all, two interesting parts for the study: no sexual imprinting, so the parents didn't have much of an impact on it, and they weren't sorting them, partners weren't related, weren't similar to them in terms of these physical characteristics. But as I said, the physical characteristics they chose aren't necessarily the ones that we were previously talking about.
Right.
We're not talking about height and BMI. So what about if we look at this in sexual imprinting on some of these physical attributes that we are talking about. One thing that's interesting, and we see this in animals, is that animals do also mate based on their similarity to one another to some extent. We call it assortative mating. So animals that are similar in some traits may be attracted to one another and form pair bonds, and that's what's attracting them, their similarity. Similarly, animals might be attracted to something that is different from them. But one thing that is interesting is that imprinting has also been well studied in animals. So imprinting being learning that happens very early on in childhood, and then is fixed after that point. It doesn't update. Famously, Conrad Lorenz made those geese follow him around because they all thought he was their mother, right? So that's the kind of thing that we're talking about. And there has been there's some work that it's well-founded. This is also influences their choice of sexual partner, their choice of mate later on. So actually a really nice study on zebra finches. They manipulated the colour of the beaks of the zebra finches, and not only did the colour of the parents' beak influence the choice of mate, the zebra finches actually preferred a more extreme version of their parents. So they set their parents as a kind of a point. So this is what my dad looked like. I want to see something that looks more red.
More dad than dad.
I want more dad than dad, or more mum than mum, depending who what they are.
I bet you do.
So is there any evidence for this sexual imprinting on some kind of physical attractiveness in humans? I did find one paper, and what they did is, unlike the previous one, this was experimental. So they're trying to find out whether independent judges would rank the father of a father of a woman as similar to her husband.
Okay.
Right? And in order to control for the fact that people are attracted to people who are similarly attractive, and as these things could be heritable, you'd expect the father to be of equal similar attractiveness to the daughter. And all this kind of stuff. So the way they controlled it is they looked at, and to bring right back to stuff we were talking about in Zach's section, adopted daughters.
Mm-hmm.
So the father is unrelated, so it could be seen as independent to some extent of the daughter's facial features. So the judges reported that the most significant similarities in facial traits were between the daughter's husband and the father. So out of the pictures that they had in front of them, they correctly identified the daughter's husband and her stepfather as the most similar.
So it was not the dad that wasn't genetically related?
Yeah, the dad's not genetically related. So they also found that this was more the case if the daughter had received more emotional support from her father.
Yeah, I was just going to ask if there was an effect of, like, a better father.
Yeah, there seems to be, yeah. So there is potentially out there that ladies, you are attracted to your fathers, especially if you get on well with your father.
Yeah, only ladies. There's no men effects at all.
We just don't want to think about those.
No Oedipus complex here.
So even though, you know, we think we know what is attractive out there, there's plenty of room in us, both in terms of when we're learning, when we're very young, and in terms of matching our own various aspects of ourselves onto our potential partners. So even though, you know, our own opinions of attractiveness in terms of our day-to-day life, who we find attractive, who we fall in love with, does seem to be fairly subjective, because we're all different, and that causes us to like different people. I just want to end on one note, which is, what makes people more attractive? And I think we all know the answer to this. Alcohol!
And I'm going to close out the show I had two games planned and I couldn't decide between them, so we're going to do both, and they're actually going to complement each other quite beautifully, I think. So with the open topic of love, we're going to start, and both are just little quizzes. They both have three questions, and the first one we're going to talk about is dating customs throughout the world. Just three quick questions on it, and a little quiz that I like to call, I do anything for love, but I won't do that. Music cue now.
Oh, I would do anything for love.
So, first I'm going to have to ask you guys, if you are a Hindu Balinese and you want to get married, what part of your body will you have to take a metal file to?
If you want to get married?
Yeah, if you want to get married.
Your nipples? Fingernails?
Your nipples.
I'll say teeth.
So your nipples and your teeth? Your teeth is correct. Yeah. Dan correctly identified.
You just don't have to be Hindu to do that.
Werewolves of London.
In a ritual tooth filing that ushers in adulthood and out of puberty, a Brahmin priest oversees it. It's a very painful process.
I can imagine.
Which the Balinese believe. They grind down the upper canines to the level of your incisors on the top row of your teeth. And that they believe that gets rid of greed, lust, anger, jealousy, and intoxication in preparation for marriage.
And vampirism.
Yeah.
It would encourage vampirism.
They just absolutely hate vampires. Well, I think you guys taught me something today. So in the next one, we're going to go somewhere very different in the world. We're going to go to Buffalo, New York.
Oh, God.
I'm going to ask you to pretend that you are, I'm going to ask you to pretend that you're in Buffalo, New York, because God forbid you're ever going to actually go there.
As soon as this quiz is over, you forget you did that.
So you are in the Polonia district.
Okay.
It is Easter Monday, so the Monday following Easter. How are you going to get a date? And then, why are you going to regret it on the Tuesday afterwards?
You're going to buy them a kind of a creamy sauce with buffalo wings in it, and you're going to regret it because you forgot you were lactose intolerant.
Oh.
If I know what I think about Buffalo, New York, you're sort of... you get tanked at a bar, find the first person you find, go to bed, and then wake up the next morning and really take your first look at them.
Well, Buffalo, I'm here for you. And the answer is much more magical, and neither of you are correct.
Oh.
If you were on Easter Monday in Polonia, which is actually, so it's a Polish district, and they also do this in Poland, it is Dingus Day. That is what Easter Monday is called. And on Dingus Day, it is traditional, and now it's a very big thing, they do parades now and stuff, for men to sprinkle water and douse women water with super soakers and buckets as a form of flirting.
Like a kind of wet t-shirt competition thing. Is this where this
is
leading?
A wet t-shirt parade, if
you will. A wet t-shirt parade. There are no prizes.
I thought that would be a prize.
So wait a minute, how do they go to... what happens after that? They shoot them with a super soaker and...
So, and then on Tuesday, females get to retaliate.
Oh, that's good.
By throwing dishes and crockery at men.
That's a lopsided fight.
So apparently, the more modern...
That sounds like the Buffalo, New York, I know.
That's actually not part of the tradition, is that what you're trying to say?
So apparently...
any given day.
Apparently, more modern interpretations of it, female will just throw water back at males on Monday.
Oh, well.
But I'm a traditional guy, and I want to see someone lose some of their well-filed teeth after our adventure around the world. And so we're going to end up in, we're going to actually have to go back in time to a couple centuries. We're going to end up in Austria. I actually wrote this question beautifully, so I think I'm just going to read it. We all know that Austrian dances are already a hot spot to pick up a man, undoubtedly.
Yeah.
But how would you go about making sure that you would have a potential suitor, you would be able to get a man, and make sure that he actually detects your pheromones? So this is from the perspective of... woman.
Okay.
How are you going to get a
suitor?
What you want to
do is... Okay, this is Austria, right?
Yeah.
So sausages.
Okay.
Okay, so what you want to do is you want to get the sausage and you want to put it under your armpit. And you want to walk up to...
We're talking about the food item sausage, right?
Yeah, food item sausage. And you want to walk up to the man that you like the look of there. You slap him across the face with the sausage, above the nose, also on the top lip. And that is why they are referred to as sausage parties.
Just a horrible pile of misinformation.
Yeah. Sausage fest.
But beautifully and disturbingly close.
My thought was, this is Austria, right? A few centuries back.
This is Austria.
Woman, as everybody knows, a few centuries back in Austria, nothing but tank tops. So the woman, they would dance around the street with their arms up, and halter tops, and just run face, or, you know, jump with their armpit at a guy's face, was my thought. I didn't know there was a sausage involved.
Well, I think the sausage part is important because that's where the phrase "you're the worst" comes from. Hey-o!
I
won't be sour about that loss.
So David was teetering on the correct answer, but you assume that Austrians aren't as healthy as they actually are. So it's tradition, or it was traditional, that at a traditional dance, women would put slices of apples under their arms and then perform a traditional dance so that they get the apples all nice and sweaty, and then present them to a man they liked, and if he ate it, then that was him accepting.
Well, you'd have to, right? That's the. I think if anything, we've learned today is we need the true. The problem with studying love is the definition of love. I think eating the sweaty apple is the true definition of love.
Okay.
I'm going to put that on a hallmark.
So where do the halter tops come in?
In your brain, I think. So that was the first quiz.
You guys want an apple?
Tour around the world. And my second quiz, which again I was split on deciding between these two, is actually a quiz on paraphilias, which are kind of like sexual fetishes. Mm-hmm. And they've all got some really crazy names. So I'm just going to give you guys three. I'll try and give you a bit of a hint on each one. I don't want to give it away too much. And then we'll have you guys guess in a little quiz I like to call I'd Do Anything for Love, and I Will Also Do That. I would do anything for love. Oh, I would do anything for
love. Oh, I would do anything for love.
I'm so sorry.
Okay.
Okay, so we'll start tame. We're going to start with eproctophilia.
Eproctophilia.
And this is our opening, and I'm going to tell you that I'm not going to give you any clue besides the fact that this is probably the only one that you could potentially get some etymology out of.
Okay. As in proctologist.
Yeah, I was thinking proctologist. All right,
so do you have a guess?
Yes.
Eproctophilia.
The butt.
I was going to say butt stuff.
Would you like to specify when you say butt stuff?
Okay, so it's eproctophilia.
Eproctophilia.
As in E, like the internet age.
As in the letter E.
Wireless internet.
E is not E hyphen, proctophilia.
So it's like the iPod for paraphilias. It's the eproctophilia.
Eprod. You're very close, but neither of you are correct. Eproctophilia is for our fine friends out there who are into farts.
Oh. Oh. E as in from.
Yeah, E as in emissions.
Oh.
Okay, so our next one.
Well, there's a.
Is catoptronophilia, which sounds pretty cool. And my hint for this, this is a hint that neither of you are probably going to get, but two catoptronophilias.
I hope I don't get this, all right.
Two kind of famous ones. The real one is R&B singer Neo, and the fictional one that was also. Is Patrick Bateman from
Patrick Bateman
American
from Psycho.
Psycho.
American Psycho.
Oh, not the biologist.
No.
No, that's Bateson. Okay.
Catoptronophilia.
And I know what time pronounce it?
Catoptronophilia.
Catoptronophilia.
I'll be really impressed because I couldn't even get the etymology of this.
David.
Is it that they enjoy imagining killing women?
No. No, it is not.
I already guessed. Oh. I said David.
Oh,
no,
I think.
We'll go again.
I'm interested because you're
no,
really
I
confident.
No, I want to.
You want to go last?
Yeah.
So Neo and Christian Bale, then, huh?
Patrick Bateman, not.
Oh, sorry,
not Christian
Neo.
Bale.
I don't know who that is, really.
Must be Patrick
Bateman.
So
axes.
The reason I say that singer Neo is because he wrote an entire song about it.
I don't even know what he sings. Neo.
Yeah, you probably won't know the song.
Neo. Yeah.
You guys aren't hip.
I know Neo from
I'm
the Matrix.
Hip.
Axes?
I know all the words to rap.
Is it about axing?
It is not axes. What is your guess?
Is it watching yourself during sex?
It is watching yourself during sex. So Neo, R&B singer Neo, has a song called Mirrors.
Oh, okay.
And Mirrors is about him either having sex or masturbating in front of the mirror. And of course, Patrick Bateman loved doing that in American Psycho.
I didn't see that movie.
So my last one, and my only hint for this, is that I'm relatively confident that you guys are at least a little bit pygophilic.
Pygophilic?
Yeah.
Can you spell it?
P-Y-G-O.
Yeah, this isn't one of your urine things again, is it?
I believe I can fly.
No.
P-Y-gophilic?
Yeah.
Smaller things.
Yeah, a pygophilic, I'm not sure the pronunciation.
A sexual attraction towards...
This is something I imagine that you guys have at least a little bit of.
See,
is
anything I say now, I'm going
to... I know, that's why.
I'm slightly worried now. This is more about Zach than it does about us, potentially.
Things smaller than you?
Is it a sexual attraction to, like, numbers?
I don't want to go looking
sorry.
Just
learned
wait.
Too much.
We'll cut that bit out, right, guys?
Never look through David's internet browser history.
Last
it's just
a
series of numbers. Why do you think they put that calculator on there?
So, a pegophilic, that's someone who's into butts.
Oh.
Which makes me laugh because it's so different than e-procto.
Oh, God.
And so that was, I would do anything for love, and I will also do that.
Well done. Oh, well, that's our show for this week. Hopefully that's put you... Oh, that last section has put you in the mood for Valentine's Day.
That last session was a real...
And all the sessions before that have horribly destroyed your ideas about the concept of love.
Yes, exactly. So we've gone from how the complicated realities of animals feeling love. We've gone to the chemical realities of humans smelling love. And we've gone to looking at people who look like you. And ending up back to smelling again. Yeah, back to smelling, as we learnt about the Austrian sweaty apples and people that just love the farts. So this is the high concept. This is our highbrow science podcast, Fact Naturally, from St. Andrews University. And that's us for this week. Bye, everyone.
Bye.
See you next week.
I'm so alone.
Goodbye, my lover. Goodbye, my friend. You have been the one. You have been the one for me. Goodbye, my lover. Goodbye, my friend. You have been the one. You have been the one for me.
Can we be called Sister Fact 2?
Hi. Welcome to the all-male Sister Fact 2. Sister Fact 2.